Virginia, too, and an economic strategy designed to black out the system while demonstrators gather in Washington to refuse fascism. Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy warned yesterday that if the shutdown of the federal government continues for another week, it could force him to close down some air travel. And he blamed the shutdown on the Democrats. The Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress accused the Democrats of causing the shutdown, while Democrats point out that Republicans hold all three levers of power in the House, the Senate, and the White House. The latest opinion poll indicates the majority of those polled, 52%, blame the Republicans, while 42% blame the Democrat. And it appears maybe the voters did too last night. Joining me in the studio this morning are John Nichols, veteran political analyst, blogger, and editor of The Nation magazine, and a longtime guest on Pacifica What's at Stake. Good morning, John Nichols.
Good morning, Berna. It is an honor and a pleasure to be with you today.
And we are certainly excited to have you, given that you're on the West Coast, but you're up to join us this morning.
Of course.
We also have Dr. Wilmer J. Leon, independent political analyst, author, and host of his podcast, Connecting the Dots, I believe. He's also a frequent guest on What's at Stake. Welcome back, Dr. Leon.
Well, Verna, good morning. Thank you very much. And John, good to see you.
It is a pleasure.
So, gentlemen, These midterms, as dramatic and as successful as they were, are not the midterms electing members to Congress that could shift the power dynamic in the House and Senate. However, some analysts suggest these midterms results could be a bellwether for next year's midterm elections. Are they an indicator of things to come? What do you think, John?
Absolutely. Yes, they are. Now, historically, when we've looked at off-year elections like this, because they aren't nationwide, they're patterns from different places, you can usually find exceptions to the rule. And you can say, well, they give us some indication, maybe, but we should be careful about making predictions off them. That's not what happened last night. Last night, in the first nationalized, you know, to the extent that you did up races in a lot of places, test of people's reaction to Donald Trump's presidency, which began with his election almost a year ago, Democrats won everywhere. And they didn't win by a little. They often won by a lot. You have a case in New York City of massive increased turnout. Zohran Mamdani elected mayor with more than a million votes, the first time that has happened in modern history. You have Virginia, not just the governorship, but the down ballot races, and in the state legislature, they have won the largest majority in modern history. New Jersey, at the governor's level, people thought the New Jersey race was going to be close. Mikey Sherrill has won with, you know, what's on the cusp of, at least very near, a landslide. It was an overwhelming victory. Then you go to Pennsylvania. Three Supreme Court justices that Democrats backed. If Republicans had won the race and they poured millions of dollars into the race, if Republicans had won, they could have flipped control of the Supreme Court in the ultimate battleground state, a place that Donald Trump has, you know, fought for in his presidential elections very bitterly. Democrats won the Supreme Court seats overwhelmingly. And then you start going out around the country to Georgia, where Democrats had massive gains. Excuse me. Where I apologize, but thank you. But Democrats had massive gains, shifted places that had voted overwhelmingly for Trump. In Cincinnati, Ohio, where J.D. Vance's brother was running for mayor, he was wiped out as a candidate. The Democrat won, you know, without a blink of the eye. In special elections for legislative seats all over the country, West Coast, Midwest, etc., Democrats won race after race after race. I could go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing to understand is, the core thing to understand is, when you have that level of rejection of a governing party, you have a signal from the people that should encourage Democrats and progressives to go into 2026 with a confidence that I think even a day ago they didn't have.
So, Dr. Leon, so President Trump said that the reason the Democrats won so decisively, of course, he didn't say decisively, he just said because the Democrats won was because he wasn't on the ballot and because of the federal government shutdown. Your thoughts about that? But he did do all that he could to try to bring out Republican voters in those key states. I mean, he told them that they would rue the day that they didn't, that they voted to change their lives, and that any Jewish person in New York that voted for Mamdani was a self-hating Jew. I mean, and on and on and on. So what are your thoughts about that, Dr. Leon? Was it because Trump wasn't on the ballot? He does bring out the voters. He wasn't on the ballot.
Well, as a person, he was not on the ballot, but his persona was on the ballot. His policy was on the ballot. And I'm in Maryland, so I got to see the Virginia campaign ads. And he, whether it was Abigail Spanberger or whether it was Jay Johnson against Meares, they tied the candidates directly to the president. So this definitely was a very clear admonition, a very clear statement that people are not pleased with the economy. People are not pleased with the fact that the president and his administration have failed or have decided to chase immigrants more than chase an economy. But you can look at, for example, in the Virginia State House races, they added, when I checked this morning, they added 13 seats, and all of the, they went from a 51-50 margin, or I think, yeah, I think, to now 64 to, I don't know what the other end was, but so to John's point, yes. And the other thing that is important to see here is not what stood out to me more than the percentage of victory was the turnout. Historic rates of turnout in New York, historic rate of turnout in Virginia, historic rate of turnout in New Jersey. So in an off year, not even a midterm, in an off year election, there was so much turnout. But here's, for me, the caveat. What will the Democrats do with this? Because when I listened, for example, to Andrew Cuomo's concession speech, the first thing he said was, and we all know, he is Democrat Party elite.
Establishment.
He said, We ran against an ideology that is challenging the basis of the Democrat Party.
Well, that's a good point you raised, Dr. Leon. Go ahead.
Before he even talked about the New York City race, he took this to the national level and said basically that Zohran Mamdani was challenging the fundamental base of ideology as it relates to the party. So the question now to me is, how prevalent is Cuomo's mindset, and what will the Democrats recognize what the electorate is obviously telling them, or will they maintain course and speed?
Well, also, Hakeem Jeffries, who ultimately endorsed Mamdani, was asked, so does this represent the future of the Democratic Party? And he rushed to say no, emphatically. But the question is, as you posed, Dr. Leon, what will the Democrats do with this? What did they take? What is their takeaway from last night? Shouldn't, you know, because his campaign was based on economics, the cost of living, affordable housing, childcare, So what will the White House take from this? Because it seems like they need to adjust their message as well. Go ahead, John.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Let me throw in a couple thoughts here. The White House will not adjust its message. The president is a combative president. He likes to fight. In fact, he probably enjoys a fight more than a negotiation or a standard competition. So he'll be very combative. There's no question of that. The question now is whether Republicans in Congress become more afraid of the voters than they are of the president. Up to this point, their fear of the president has been overwhelming because he threatens to upend them in primaries, things of that nature, to endorse an opponent and to push incumbents out. Now those incumbents have to look at the reality that if they are so closely associated with Trump, even, you know, in the face of everything that's happened, that they might well be defeated in a November election. And so there's going to be pressure on Trump now, not merely from the Democrats, but from his own party. That's important. That is significant. Now, as regards the Democrats, my colleague is exactly right. The Democratic Party struggles with direction. It struggles often with showing backbone. Now, what happened, though, tonight or last night was that Zohran Mamdani in New York won against the Democratic establishment. They did not rush to back him once he got the nomination. In fact, they resisted it. And he just went forward. He offered a new model for going to the people directly and reaching out to folks who hadn't backed him and winning them over. Ultimately, he did get Governor Hochul's endorsement, as well as a very cautious endorsement from Hakeem Jeffries. But I think that both the governor and the minority leader in the House were secondary players at that point because Mamdani was already doing so well. Those leaders on the Democratic side now have to assess whether they have a party that they are leading or whether, in fact, these election results, a lot of other factors, suggest that the people have the potential to lead, that the grassroots of the party has the potential to lead. And their adjustment to that will be definitional. If they adjust to it and say, look, we want to win, and we know where the action is, we are going to, you know, recognize that somebody has pushed the boundaries of the party a little bit, and that we'd better be open to that, we'd better be ready for that, then they can make a lot out of this. This can be a very beneficial election result, even for the leadership of the party. On the other hand, if they continue to resist, if they deny what everyone at the grassroots is feeling today, which is an extraordinary joy and sense of empowerment and a belief that the electoral process can be used not merely to defeat Republicans, but to advance economic and social and racial justice. If they begin to recognize that energy, they have the potential, as again my colleague points out, not merely to, you know, narrowly win elections, but to boost turnout in ways that create an anti-Trump and a pro-justice wave in 2026. That's what they should be aiming for.
But we'll see if the Republicans in Congress are more fearful of the voters or more fearful of President Trump.
Well, Verna, to that point, I think John is correct, and I think we're starting to see some fissures in the coalition on the Republican side. You've got when Trump called John Thune in the Senate and said, I want you to abolish the filibuster, Thune said no.
Yeah.
He said, I'll paraphrase here, that's very short-term thinking for a very long-term risk. And then he's talking to the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, Muppet Mike. And Muppet Mike says the same thing.
Yeah.
Muppet Mike says, no, Mr. President. And those are three words that Trump ain't used to hearing. No, Mr. President. Even though the filibuster issue doesn't impact the House, Muppet Mike was still very clear. That's a bad idea. So we're seeing. So one other point about what this says to the Democrats and their leadership. Some attribute this to Gandhi. Some attribute this, I think, to Ledru Rollin. There go the people. I must follow them, for I am their leader. For Jeffries to come out very clearly and emphatically and say, no, this is not the face of the party. For Cuomo to make his point, that says to me, Hakeem, homie, you still don't get the message. You're stuck on stupid.
So it's the economy, stupid. The message from this.
Didn't learn from 2024 in terms of Kamala and messaging as it relates to Gaza, for example. There go the people. I must follow them, for I am their leader. When they start to grasp that, they'll have a better understanding of reality.
Well, it's my understanding that the president is meeting with the Senate or with the Republican in the White House today, and he is going to urge them to hold the line on the shutdown of the federal government. So we'll see how this all plays out. But also, what's on the horizon is a redistricting war. Yeah. Because Prop 50 won handily in California. Handily, 64.7 voted yes, 36 point something voted no. So, but that can launch a whole war across the country because there are others. Yeah. Go ahead, John.
I'm so glad you brought this up, Bruno, because this is, I'm in California right now. And what I can tell you is they thought with Prop 50 that they would win. Obviously, that's why Gavin Newsom and others put it on the ballot. But when they did so, Republicans launched a major pushback. They tried very, very hard to stop it. The Republicans thought that they could derail this. They were wiped out. This is a 2-1 victory for a redistricting model that protects and advances Democratic interests in the face of Donald Trump. So what we know is that when people are educated about these issues, when they learn about it and they have an opportunity to weigh in, they actually weigh in on behalf of models and avenues that might create a Democratic majority in the House. So as we move into this battle over districting and see what goes on, Trump is going to continue to pressure states like Indiana, Missouri, and others to move seats. But in some of the states where they're doing that, where the Republicans are trying to grab seats, they have what is sometimes recalled or referred to as a people's override, i.e. you can petition onto the ballot a referendum that says, we don't accept these changes. And these are in these Republican states. If they petition onto the ballot and qualify, then they put the redistricting on hold, again, in Ohio and in Missouri, several of these other states. So where I think we are likely to end up now is a situation where in the districting fights, Trump, he might be able to force some states to give him a slight advantage. It won't be sufficient enough to overcome a blue wave. The bigger concern and the thing we must be looking at is that the Supreme Court is prepared, it looks like, to meddle with or even upend the Voting Rights Act. If that is done, then you do have the potential in a number of southern states to see majority black districts redrawn in a way that would seek to harm Democratic representation. If that begins to happen, that's a really serious issue. And so while we have encouraging news from California and just this wave of people's empowerment, we have to keep our eye on the Supreme Court.
Okay. Dr. Leon, I'm going to give you the last word here. Your thoughts, any final thoughts before we pull out?
Yes, this is a 15-round fight. Yep. And to show you how old I am, because they only fight 12 now, not 15. this is a 15-round fight. The Democrats won the first round. I'll call it a 10-7 round on a 10-point must system. They won 10-7, but they're fighting Tyson. And it's going to be a long slog. They better find a message. They better figure out messaging, and they better listen to their electorate, or we're going to have a repeat of 24.
Okay, that was Dr. Wilmer J. Leon, independent political analyst, author, blogger, and host of his podcast, Connected Dots. And we also heard our guest this morning, John Nichols, veteran political analyst, blogger, and editor of The Nation magazine. Thank you both for helping us sort through this and unravel the results of this midterm election, gentlemen. Thank you so much, Berna.
Great to be with you both.
Yes, indeed. So our next guest, Paul Street, political commentator, writer, and social critic, says we are not slipping into fascism. We're already in it. There's no time to wait around for what he calls our rigged elections. And he's calling on the people to join his movement called Refuse Fascism. Welcome to What's at Stake, Paul Street. Good morning.
Hey there. Thank you so much for having me on.
So the nation just held midterm elections and we witnessed some significant grounds politically were gained for the Democrats. Proposition 50 passed in California, which means Democrats can redraw the maps to increase the chances of electing more Democrats and taking back control of the Congress. But you seem to be saying elections and politics as usual aren't enough, that the people need to rise up and take to the streets.
Yeah, it's insufficient. Just to be clear, if I lived in New York, I imagine I would have voted for Mamdani. We want to unite and everyone and anyone who hates what the Trump fascist regime is doing, not just to this country, but to the world. And that includes folks who are still into voting. We are not shaming people who voting, but we are starting today a movement towards a mass resistance beyond single day elections and beyond single day protests in Washington, D.C. itself. And we will be meeting at the Washington Monument today at 11 a.m. to begin a march and a rally that is meant to initiate, yes, a different type of politics, a type of politics calculated to try and create a groundswell, a political earthquake, to create a political crisis. Leading to the removal of the Trump regime prior to future elections. That is true. I make the heart attack analogy. I think that right now telling folks that the way to defeat this regime is through electoral politics, through the next elections, you know, hold the line, get to the midterms and get even to 2028, it's a little bit like coming up on somebody in the middle of a heart attack and saying, take two aspirin and make sure to go to your regularly scheduled appointment with a not very good doctor who may not even be alive in 1 year, you know, or in 3 years.
What are you calling on folks to do, Paul, in this mobilization? Are you calling for more marches, more rallies? Exactly. What are you calling?
We're trying to plant a flag here and function as a magnet to get people to come to D.C. from the immediate area, but also from all around the country, with the goal of surrounding the White House, surrounding the fascist-packed Supreme Court and the U.S. Capitol, with the demand that Trump must go now. He must go. As soon as possible and before the next elections, because, you know, these elections are too late. This thing is moving very quickly. They are shredding the rule of law. They're making a mockery of due process. They're deploying the military on U.S. soil, disappearing immigrants. I mean, they're reversing the gains not only of the 1960s, but even of the 1860s in Reconstruction, violating international law, zapping boats in the Caribbean, extrajudicial assassinations. Trump, right now, we are waiting for the Supreme Court for an emergency shadow docket ruling, potentially green lighting the occupation of Chicago and other cities with the U.S. military, which is going to be critical context for the 2026 midterms if they get away with that, which they very well may. We are potentially looking at rigged elections taking place in the shadow in blue cities of military occupation. So, yeah, we are calling for a very serious mass resistance movement that, you know, to quote Dr. Martin Luther King in 1967, dislocates the normal functioning of business as usual and sends a message to the establishment and the ruling classes in this country that things aren't going to go on in the normal kind of way as long as you insist on permitting this regime, a fascist regime, not just an authoritarian regime.
Yes.
Not just an, it's authoritarian, you bet.
So
it's an oligarchy too, but it's more than that. It's something else. We're in a different kind of historical moment right now. Mm-hmm. Some of the language we have is not meeting that moment. It's not commensurate to what we're dealing with, which is a neo-fascist regime. Thank you.
You know, Paul, you make a very persuasive case. I mean, in terms of our audience, you're probably preaching to the choir. We already know that the question is, how do you dismantle this regime? How do you go about it? What is the smartest way? You're calling for rallies and mobilization. We've had those. We've had mass mobilizations, the No Kings rally, where some 7 billion, a million rather, people gather across this country and even foreign countries as well. Are you calling on a nonviolent protests?
Determined, nonviolent, but longer term presence around the country, but particularly in the nation's capital. Yes, there have been gigantic single day protests. Trump seems to write these single day protests off and even double down. He seems to get provoked by them and get even worse. You saw that AI video he put up in the wake of No King's Day too. No, we're talking about now moving beyond single day protests, from protest to resistance, to sustain, determined, and absolutely nonviolent.
So you want people to come and show up and surround the White House and surround the Supreme Court and demand Trump's removal. That's what you're calling for.
Yes. We need to create a groundswell, an earthquake leading to the removal of this regime. Now, it could start with the removal of players in the regime. It doesn't have to start with Trump, but ultimately this regime has to go, and it has to go as soon as possible before it can inflict any more damage on the world. This thing is moving very, very quickly. It has great direction and speed and momentum. And we feel like, and I mean, even when you talk about the midterms, that would be about seating people in January of 2027, assuming.
Right.
That, and the track record, some of your previous speakers here said, had some very important reflections on how poorly the Democrats have conducted themselves, even when they have held power. And they've conducted themselves in a way that's left a vacuum that has allowed the Republican Fascist Party to rule.
Okay.
Now with
right.
impunity. Right.
So, Paul, let's think this through. The people take to the streets. Trump calls out the National Guard troops. People are injured, pepper sprayed, arrested, maybe even some fatalities. Then what? What's the strategy for that?
Well, first of all, taking on a regime like this is never risk-free. There's always considerable danger involved. I have been involved in direct action protests at the Broadview facility outside Chicago. I'm from Chicago. I have seen people hit with pepper spray, you know, canisters and tear gas canisters and all of that. That's right of it. But there's something riskier than that. There's something more dangerous than that. And that is the potential full cementing and consolidation of fascist rule on the part of a party and a regime that vilifies immigrants, that tears up international law, that is very underestimated issue, rapidly assaulting livable ecology. I could go on. So that's the greater risk. Yes, there's no risk-free confrontation with authoritarian regimes.
Okay, well, yes, and in throughout history, we saw our beloved ancestors took some serious beatdowns in the 60s for our freedom. I'm remembering Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, but this is six decades later. We have access to different resources and tools, but that's one version of how the mobilization could unfold, clearly. And that's not how you and the organizers of Refuse Fascism see it.
There are divisions within the elite, and we're seeing some of them, and they're playing out. We are not calling for just simply a romantic mass rank and file rebellion against the whole ruling class of the country. We are seeking to encourage the decent members of the elite and the decent parts of the country to embolden them and to give them courage. We would like to see a dialectic develop between protest and resistance in the streets and noncompliance in the streets and in the public squares on one hand, and resistance and noncompliance at the elite level. And, you know, you see these federal district court decisions that are very different than what the Trump fascist Supreme Court rules. You see rumblings within the military, within the institutions. There are forces that would like to realize how rapidly this is moving and could move, as has happened in other countries in different times. We had a resignation of a president during a term in 1974.
Okay, so let me just, I just want to interrupt you, but because I know that this starts at 11 a.m. today, the mobilization.
It does, at the Washington Monument.
Okay. All right, so if people want to participate in that, they should report to the Washington Monument. I assume there'll be speeches or...
There absolutely will.
Okay.
And then we're going to march over to the Supreme Court and the U.S. Capitol, and anyone and everyone of all perspectives politically that hates what this regime is doing is strongly invited and welcome there.
Spokesperson for Refuse Fascism, Paul Street, political commentator, writer, and social critic. Paul, thank you for joining us today on What's
Thank
at
you
State.
So much.
From letting your ballot do the talking through electoral politics to letting your feet do the walking and mass mobilization on the streets to hitting them where it hurts the most, in the pocketbook, the wallet, the purse, the bottom line. Our next guests say it's time to black out the system. Right after this message, stay with us.
Peace, this is your social justice calendar for the week of November the 3rd, 2025. On November the 5th at 1 p.m., Mothers Outreach Network and Harvard's Access to Justice Lab will host a virtual session highlighting the latest report from one of the Mother Up Guaranteed Income Pilot projects. For more information and to link to the register for email, send it to Melody at mothersoutreachnetwork.org. Thursday, November the 6th, from 7 to 9 p.m., Africa World Now Project and Bloom Bars present the film Thomas Sankara, The Upright Man by Robin Sheffield, followed by a post-screening discussion with Paul Sankara, brother of Thomas Sankara, at 3222 11th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. The film is a detailed history of Sankara's brief four-year rule and his revolutionary program for African self-reliance. Information at Bloom Bars. On November the 8th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, located at 2714 Georgia Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., join author Nikisha Breeze in conversation with Professor Greg Thomas on A Mutiny of Mourning, followed by a special screening of Stages of Titanic Blackness. Return, remember. For more information, visit Sankofa.com. On November the 9th at 12:30 p.m., Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church, located at 4300 16th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., will hold the seminar Financial Strategies for Difficult Times. Speaker Marky Baker will lay out ideas and suggestions to help us get through the challenging financial times we are facing. For more information, reach out to scblume@gmail.com. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar hosts, helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to What's at Stake on WPFW 89.3 FM. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, recently over 7 million demonstrators across the U.S. and overseas took the streets during the No Kings mobilization. If nothing more, that makes a statement to the world that 7 million people are thoroughly upset with the Trump administration and prepared to flex their economic muscle to cripple the system. Imagine if an economic strategy could be conceived that would bring the system to a grinding halt just long enough to send a strong message. Well, Isaiah Rucker Jr. is founder of Blackout the System, and Corey Schaefer is the founder of the Take It Back movement. They have been strategizing on a coordinated economic boycott. Welcome, gentlemen. Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. Make sure you unmute yourselves.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you.
Yes. So, Isaiah, let's start with you. Your boycott is scheduled from November 25th through December 2nd through Thanksgiving. How is it structured, and what are you asking people to boycott?
So, first of all, this is not particularly just a boycott. This is a blackout. And so what that consists of is the combination of boycott and strike. What we're asking is for people to separate their spending, their human resources from these corporations and this corrupt government. We're finding that the only way you can talk to anyone in this nation is through capitalism when it's time for change. And so we've developed a way where people can start divesting from the system, and also encouraging people to step away from work, decrease productivity. When we take a look at the United States GDP, the productivity of the United States people and the spending of the United States people is where the bulk of the money comes from. And so a lot of these organizations, they got their money together, they formed PACs, they purchased politicians, and those politicians that we elected and put in position have made policies that are detrimental to the people. And so they voted with their pocketbook. And so it's time for us to use our pocketbook to drive a wedge and change the conversation.
Now, you said step away from work. That's going to be a challenge for a lot of folks. What exactly are you asking them to do when you say that?
Honestly, we're asking them to do as much as they possibly can. When we take a look at the current climate of our United States, and we see Amazon laying off 30,000 employees, we see UPS laying off 48,000 employees, what's the alternative? Right. We have to make a statement. And gentleman Paul before, he talked about how risky things are. I like to quote Jim Rohn. He said, everything is risky, no matter what you do when you step outdoors. But why not take the risk when you're talking about democracy? Why not take the risk when you're talking about your children? And so the blackout is set for us to flex our economic muscle, taking our money back and taking our labor back. And we're asking people to participate all 7 days. If they can't participate all 7 days, 6 days. If not 6 days, 5 days. It's not about some of us doing all of it. It's about all of us doing some. And I got that from Corey because, look, we have to remember that this is a collective action. And we're getting as many people as possible on board. This is not the first wave of our blackouts. The first wave was September the 16th through the 20th, and it brought amazing awareness across the nation. That's why a lot of people hear about it now. We had about 48 countries across the world standing in solidarity with us then. And then we also had so many people, like I think thousands and thousands of stickers going across the world where people were posting stickers and communicating the message, blackout the system, because it's not just felt right here in the United States. It's felt across the world. And so as we come together under unity across races, cultures, and classes, we're coming against three pillars. One is equality. Two is justice. And the third is equity. And I think every fight that's taking place right now in the United States fall up under those pillars.
Okay, so let's bring Corey into the conversation. So, Corey, what exactly, how does this look if people decide to start to divest and to step away from their jobs? What exactly have they done in the past? You said this is the second wave, and what are you asking them to do at this point?
Absolutely. So we come from the fact that the overarching issue in our society is greed, corporate greed, political greed, greed for power and control. So the main thing that we need to do is show them that, hey, when we come together, we are actually the ones in power, in control. And really what has happened is kind of since the internet and technology has taken over and really made us a lot more productive, since when that happened, we had to have the money from the ultra wealthy to fund those things, then we get into this unequal relationship where we feel that we rely on the ultra wealthy, and when really it should be a mutually beneficial relationship. And that's really what we are trying to show people, is that just like, you know, your boss cannot, you can't operate without your paycheck, your boss also cannot operate without you, and particularly for these large-scale corporations. So historically, we understand that a one-week action isn't going to change anything. But what this does is it galvanizes people. It starts to shift the balance of power. The way that they have ratcheted up the pressure on us for the last 50 years, this is the American people coming together and saying, no, when we come together, we have the power because we are the backbone of this country and we are the economy, not the corporations. And go ahead, Don.
So have you all identified and partnered with certain organizations and groups to be a part of this? And have you targeted specific businesses or institutions with this?
Yeah, so we're finding a lot of support across the nation. We have organizations who have stepped in, money out of politics. We have the People's Sick Day. I think a lot of they were featured on Fox News. And there's other corporations and businesses that have decided to support the work that we're doing. One of the things that I do want to answer is the question that you asked about what are we doing to divest and drive that wedge. One is we're removing our money from the bank. We're doing a bank run. Like, we understand that these banks have just taken our money. They've lent our money to these corporations. Those same corporations, again, they formed those PACs, bought politicians, and now we're experiencing the mess that we have today. And then we're also asking the ones who are participating to cancel subscriptions. We've been asking people to cancel subscriptions for a long time. And just in the first wave of Blackout the System, Jimmy Kimmel's situation took place, and it was massive. And everyone across the nation decided that they were going to start canceling their Disney subscriptions. And we've seen the power of the people right there exhibited in the first wave of Blackout the System. That impact over $3.8 billion in just a week. I think that's pretty significant. And if we continue to operate at this level and bring more and more people on to participate in these kind of resistance, we'll start seeing the conversation change.
But that was very targeted, though. That was very targeted for Jimmy Kimmel. So I'm asking, do you, on November 25th, what are you asking people to do? You don't want to say just cancel subscriptions. Do you want to target certain companies or institutions? Tell us.
So this is a complete blackout. It's a full-on economic blackout. We're asking people to, again, divest, take their money out of the banks, start slowing down your spending with large corporations. Start moving that money to small businesses, mom and pop shops, farmer markets. It's easier to stop when you're slowing down already. And also cancel those subscriptions. Any way that we can start separating our spending from these corporations, these greedy corporations and this corrupt government, that's what we want to do leading up to the blackout. Once we get to the blackout, we want to shut it all down. We don't want any spending taking place. And if you can, 100%, if you can, not work, because the productivity is really what's creating this whole exchange, right? They're utilizing our manpower and exploiting that, taking advantage of us. We're the ones that created all of this, right? We're the ones that make the billionaires, right? And so if we build the business, isn't it right that we get our fair share? Right? Isn't it right that we're able to have health care? Isn't it right that we're able to have education and food on our table? And so we're coming after those components. We're all up under the same umbrella. And that umbrella is that our veteran benefits have been attacked. That, and I'm sure everybody that's listening have someone in their family that's a veteran. Our senior citizens are being attacked, Medicare and Medicaid, disabled been attacked. We have our children been attacked. We're saying food assistance. We're talking about food in schools. We're talking about housing. We're talking about every single thing for our children being attacked. The most vulnerable in our country are being attacked, and we have to be very, very vocal about what we're going to do. And we have to have some level of excitement, passion, and aggression to make that happen. And so we can't sit on our hands, and we got to make a decision. It's either the future of our nation and our families, or let's continue down this line of fascism and see exactly what takes place. But we already know that it's going to continue to degrade the economy. It's going to continue to degrade the relationships that the people have and the relationship with the rest of the world.
Okay, so now let's say, for example, I decide to participate, just hypothetically. I take my money out of the bank, but everything requires your debit card or something. If you want to order food, you got to have money in the bank to do that. You know, if you're going to participate in society nowadays, if you want to call an Uber, you got to have money in the bank on that card to do that. You're talking about cancel subscriptions. Netflix, not so much. I don't know how many people are going to cancel that. So I just feel like people may want to do this, but maybe some more specific targeted actions might make it Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. What's happening is people are already doing it. And I always want to bring the highlight to the fact that people have been doing this for months and more people are awakening. I put a poll out on Instagram and asking people who's ready to cut, divest and cut off all the corporations. And how long are you ready to go? How far are you willing to go? I put on 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month and 3 months. And 58% of the responses said 3 months and or until it changes. Right. And so there's. The climate is that the people are ready for change and they're ready to do something, and we got to give them a target. And so with these waves of blackout the system, we're building up and building up and conditioning the people to be able to say, hey, look, we're going to stand together on an extended strike, boycott combination, blacking out the system, and we're going to do it as we build community in the background. What we're doing right now is we're collecting data and information for different states and all the community mutual aids that's out there that can support the people, that can sustain them throughout these blackouts. And so we're not leaving the people stranded. We're not leaving them without options. What we're doing is creating a system that runs alongside. We're talking about bartering again. We're talking about those exchanges, tit for tat, service for something that may be useful to me in my home. We're looking at ways to really navigate this so we can really do something and really change the dynamics of the conversation. We've already identified that this regime is a problem, but not only this regime, we've seen even Democrats sit silent. So the system isn't broken. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. We need a new system, and we got to be able to see the people again to make that happen.
So how will you know if your campaign or your blackout is a success? How will you determine that?
Well, I think that we already have made that success because what we're trying to do is build a community of people looking to change their habits long term. These blackouts are our billboard, are our advertisement for that community. And the reason we believe community is the answer is because greed is the disease. And the opposite of greed is community. And if the ultra wealthy had not taken over not only the economy, the political process, but also the media, and they've lied to us to divide us for so long, that we would be able to see this come together as American people and fix it. But because the ultra wealthy have been in control of all the levers of power in our society, we are too divided to come together right now. So we believe that we need something that unites people in a way that we haven't before. And what's a way that we can do it? The economic pain that everyone has felt. We will show them that, look, why are you working harder than ever and still falling farther behind? I think we realize that any 1 week push against the system is destined to fail, because whether we try one company this or that, it is going to make up their profits the next week. So that's where we hold these mini blackouts in hopes for or in the pursuit of a sustained general strike, because that is the only thing that is actually going to push out this regime, because it's the greedy corporations that have allowed this, because they've literally chosen power over democracy. And, you know, they've chosen profits over people for a long time.
And Verna, mm-hmm.
Yes.
We're looking for a culture shift. We're pushing for a new way, a different way of how we're spending our money. We're pushing for a different way of how we're exchanging with the person in front of us. So long, we've been divided across races, cultures, and classes, and every nuance in those categories. And they have been pitted. They've been pitting us against each other over and over and over again. So as we collectively build community across the nation, and we start building avenues and channels where we can really separate and sustain from the system, then we're going to start seeing some dramatic conversations take place, and we're going to really see the shift in this nation for the American people.
So let me ask you this: this is called a blackout. Is this targeted at African Americans only, to send a message about the disproportionate number of blacks that have been furloughed and in some cases fired through the federal government shutdown and the dismantling of DEI programs? Or are you including all Americans in this? And what kind of outreach have you done to include them?
So this is for everyone. This is so Blackout the System is a movement for unity across all races, cultures, and classes. What we like is that a lot of different organizations, people, cultures, and classes, all of them have taken on the blackout and they have made it their own. They've taken ownership and stood up and start speaking out. So when you look at some information like that, we communicate that, hey, look, it's for everyone. And we want to make, and we've done everything we can to make sure that we connect with as many people as possible. We're on all social media platforms. We've been in the newspapers. We here on the radio right now. I also work in different cities, and I'm just communicating that. We have the stickers that we send out across the nation, and they communicate. They put those stickers up. They hand them out. They have conversations with people. It's permeating the United States, and it's also flowed over into other countries. The UK, they're blacking out right now in certain areas. Australia, they're blacking out 11/11 for 11 days. And Canada is standing in solidarity with us right here in America. And so we're seeing more and more, not just the United States people, but the whole world get involved in blacking out the system. And we all understand that it's the money. It's really the money, the greed, the corruption, the lies, the deceit, and the oppressive nature of these individuals that they're placing on the people, that they can't see us anymore. And we got to make sure that.
So I noticed you stopped short of the Christmas Kwanzaa holiday. Was that deliberate?
So we're wave centric. These activities are wave centric, right? And so what we like to do is give people things that they can actually do, something that people can say, hey, look, I'm activated now. And so as they continue to do certain things, they're going to be like, I can do more. That wasn't so bad. And so you'll see some of these things increase. You might see the next wave, the third wave of black out the system during the Christmas holiday and during the new year. And so you might see it extend into February. You might see other things, but we're going to continue to pound this thing away until the conversation shift and the people have a way out, because this is just way too much. It's overloading our people, the stress, the anxiety, the frustration, the anger, all of that. The passion is rising up and people are ready for change. So when we look at kids being taken off the street, families being ripped apart right there, being blasted all across social media as if they're trying to get us conditioned for it, we have a problem.
So is there some place for people to sign up if they're interested in participating in this?
So they can go to blackoutthesystem.com. We are creating community. That's our base, is community. So they can join us in building the pressure campaign, continue to put pressures on organizations and this lofty government. They can also join us as volunteers. Right now, we're also creating an initiative for 2026. If you ever heard of Hands Across America, we're focusing on making sure people are fed and making sure the homeless have the things that they need. And so it's going to be the 40th year anniversary of Hands Across America. And we're going to recreate and amplify that message and bring people together again. We really push unity around here, and we want to make sure that people have what they need to move forward.
Corey, any final thoughts on your part? We've got about a minute left.
Absolutely. It's just, this is about long-term pushback, getting people to reorganize, to recognize that greed is the overarching systemic problem. And if that imbalance causes a lot of the other issues in our society, if we can bring people together because of this economic rot and actually show them that focusing on left versus right is going to get us nowhere. One of the things we say is if you argue with your fellow American, who's also a hard worker, just working for somebody else, trying to make their life, then you're not accomplishing anything. In fact, you're playing right into the hands of the ultra wealthy. And we believe that we've seen it with Paul's movement that just mentioned there, where, hey, we need to get people activated. We need to get them doing something. But what we believe is that they have been set out of the political process for too long. They've been told that if you stand up, you'll stand alone, that if you speak out, you'll get fired. And what Isaiah and I are really trying to do is give people a ladder of action so that they can get activated in even the smallest way. And just like he said, hey, that's not so bad. If I can do that, maybe I can talk with somebody. Maybe if I can talk with somebody, I can organize in my area. And it's all about building those chapters across the country, having people take control locally. We will help coordinate the pushback maximally, nationally, and they will push back locally.
Okay, and that was Corey Schaefer, the founder of the Take It Back movement. And earlier we heard from Isaiah Rucker Jr., founder of Blackout the System. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Next week, Kimon Freeman is in the host seat. Don't want to miss it. Thank all of our guests, John Nichols, Dr. Wilmer J. Leon, Paul Street, Isaiah Rucker Jr., and Corey Schaefer. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nocella. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
The soul of West Africa lands at Brentwood Arts Exchange's Listening Room on Friday, November 7th at 8 p.m. with Chek Amala Jabate, a master of the Ngori, the traditional West African lute. Jabate weaves stories through rhythm and song, blending ancient sounds with a modern spirit that moves both heart and feet. Details at pgparks.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Our problem is that we got too many folk in the middle who are lukewarm. Indifference, the evil's more insidious than evil itself.
That's Cornel West speaking on behalf of a mobilization this Wednesday, November 5th, the one-year anniversary of Trump's election. As Trump shreds the rule of law, sends the military into our streets, and terrorizes brown-skinned people, we are facing fascism. This is why on November 5th at 11 a.m. at the National Monument on the National Mall, RefuseFascism.org, Flair, The Handmaid's Army, Now, and many others will declare the Trump fascist regime must go now. This protest and march will kick off a sustained, nonviolent movement that grows from thousands to millions, not stopping until the people's resistance creates such a profound political crisis that Trump is removed from power. Again, the protest is at 11 a.m., Wednesday, November 5th, at the National Monument on the National Mall. More information is available at refusefascism.org.
The Capital Area Food Bank is offering free food distribution for federal workers starting now until the government reopens. Federal employees and contractors will need to show a government work ID to receive food. Distribution times and sites are as follows. Tuesdays, 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. at No Limits Outreach Ministries, 7721 Barlow Road, Hyattsville, Maryland. Wednesdays, 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. at So What Else, 6116 Executive Boulevard, North Bethesda, Maryland. Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at United Community, 7511 Fordston Road, Alexandria, Virginia. Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at Urban Outreach, 5343 C Street, Southeast, Washington, D.C. Saturdays, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Linda Ben Foundation, 10739 Tucker Street, Beltsville, Maryland. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.
Thank you, family, for standing with WPFW during our fall drive. Because of your support, we shared powerful moments. The No Kings protest, the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March, and a moving all-day broadcast on the struggles in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listeners in the Congo downloaded our radio app, tuned in, and sent us messages of gratitude, proof that your generosity connects people around the world. We came within $30,000 of our goal. If you are able, please help us close the gap and keep WPFW strong. Go to our website at wpfwfm.org, where you can donate or get our P.O. Box number of where to send checks. WPFW, Jazz and Justice, people-powered radio, connecting our communities globally. while building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Candy Shannon, host of Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
Good morning, and welcome to WPFW.